Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. We're podcasting the show. You can find out more information on our website. Go to kalw.org, click on news, and you'll see Your Call listed there. And that's where you can listen to past shows and subscribe to the podcast as well. And you can also subscribe on iTunes. If you have a show idea for us, you could drop us a line. We are at yourcall@kalw.org. And you could join the conversation today by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And also email any questions or comments or reflections you have on the program and on what you hear to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, the Trump administration has moved to open Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's one of the last untouched wilderness areas in the United States, and the administration wants to open it up to oil and gas drilling. On October 23rd, the Interior Secretary announced the opening of 1.56 million acres of the coastal plain in the refuge to oil and gas leasing, and this has been a wilderness landscape that's been protected for more than four decades. In a recent piece on Politico, our guest today, Adam Fetterman, writes that reopening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for drilling would almost certainly invite environmental groups and tribes opposed to the action to file legal complaints trying to stop it. It will also test oil companies' desire to send rigs to a remote area that has long been a rallying cry for the environmental movement, just as low crude prices are causing ExxonMobil, ConocoPhillips, and others in the industry to lay off workers. So how would increased drilling adversely affect Arctic animals, the land, and Alaska's natives? And what are the environmental impacts? Well, joining us to discuss, we're pleased to have Adam Fetterman, an award-winning journalist and reporting fellow with Type Investigations. He's written widely on environmental policy, public lands, and corporate and police spying on environmental activists. He's also written for Politico magazine, The Washington Post, Wired, Slate, The Nation, and many other publications. And his first book, Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray, was a New York Times notable book of 2017 and a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize in Biography. So it's good to have you back with us, Adam. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan. It's great to be here.
So the Trump administration has been pushing to open this refuge from back in the first administration, but as you have reported, his efforts to advance drilling in the first administration were stymied by legal challenges and the Interior Department's own flawed environmental reviews. So what's changed now? Why has the Trump administration been able to do something here just within the first year of their second term that they weren't really able to do in the first term?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, they've been able to build on all of the work and environmental impact statements that have been done both under the first Trump administration and then during, Biden's term in office, when they actually went back and did a supplemental environmental impact statement for the oil and gas leasing program in the refuge. So essentially, they have this body of work that they can use to advance leasing and then potentially seismic exploration and then ultimately, oil and gas drilling in the coastal plain of the refuge. But it was something that, it really didn't come as a surprise. The administration put out an executive order on day one in which they essentially outlined everything that they were hoping to do in Alaska. And of course, leasing in the refuge has been a top priority, not just for the Trump administration, but for the Alaska delegation and Republican administrations, essentially going back to Reagan.
Yeah, why are they so obsessed with opening up drilling in this part of Alaska specifically?
Well, it's partly because early estimates of oil and gas potential in the coastal plain of the refuge were significant. And there's been an appetite for, exploring what may be there. But I think over time, it's become kind of an ideological battle. The environmental movement successfully made the refuge a kind of poster child for conservation. It was a rallying cry for Sierra Club and other groups that were trying to sort of raise the profile of these large protected landscapes. And you know, the refuge is iconic. It's the largest refuge in the United States, you know, some 19 million acres. And when, you know, the legislation that was passed to establish the refuge in its current form, you know, created this carve out for the coastal plain, which essentially allows Congress to approve oil and gas leasing in that area, which is, you know, about 1.6 million acres. So this battle has been going on for 4 decades now, where Congress, you know, under Republican administrations and Republican Senate, et cetera, tries to pass legislation to open the refuge, but they have failed until 2017, when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed, which included a provision that Senator Murkowski drafted opening the refuge to leasing. And of course, that passed by a single vote. And you know, Trump eagerly signed it. So, you know, here we are. And you know, it is worth noting that, you know, no drilling activity has yet taken place. And as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, we're certainly going to see lawsuits and challenges to the most recent effort.
Well, and to your point about what might be at stake, the New York Times has reported that no one truly knows how much crude oil lies beneath the refuge. There's only been one exploratory well that's been drilled. That was back in the mid-80s. But the U.S. Geological Survey has estimated, just based on seismic data, that the coastal plain contains between 4.3 and 11.8 billion barrels of oil. And for context, the U.S. has produced a record 4.6 billion barrels of oil just in 2024. So that puts some of what is potentially at stake in terms of profits for the or revenue for the fossil fuel industry in some context here. If you're just joining us, I'm Ethan Elkind. You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series, and we're joined by Adam Fetterman, an award-winning journalist and reporting fellow with Type Investigations. And we're discussing the opening of oil and gas drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And Adam, it's not just about the oil and gas drilling. It's also about a new 200-mile industrial road that the Interior Department announced that it had approved. This would go through Alaska's Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Can you talk more about this road and what it would be used for?
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually two roads that are on the table. One is the 211-mile Ambler Access Road that would cut across the southern edge of the Brooks Range, so essentially the opposite side of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, to access a what is, you know, supposedly a massive copper and zinc deposit in northwestern Alaska. Also something that was advanced during the first Trump administration and then reversed under Biden and is now, you know, back on the table. And then the other road is a smaller road that would run through Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to connect the village of Cold Bay to a hospital and you know, medical services. So essentially, last a week and a half ago, when they rolled out all of these announcements, you know, Eisenbeck, Ambler, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska, where they're also pushing ahead with increased leasing and drilling, we're all sort of bundled together in this big, you know, Alaska Day announcement.
So I'd like to open the phone lines if anyone listening has been up to Alaska, perhaps been to the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and wants to talk about what that area is like, or if you have questions about what this decision to open up the land for oil and gas drilling and these roads as well, what that might mean. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email any questions or comments, concerns you might have about these latest moves to yourcall@kalw.org. Adam, I'm guessing, you know, some of our listeners might be familiar with what oil and gas drilling looks like if you've driven by pump jacks, for example, or live near these facilities, or maybe worked near or in them. But I'm just wondering if you can maybe describe for our listeners what exactly is at stake. I mean, when we're talking about opening up these lands for oil and gas drilling, what kind of effect does that have on the land, you know, visually and environmentally?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's especially stark in a place like Alaska's North Slope, where you don't have a lot of vegetation. So pipelines, roads, drilling rigs, and everything else that go along with it are quite pronounced on the landscape. I mean, I've flown over portions of the North Slope, and you know, you can see these pipelines, the network of pipelines and roads, and Prudhoe Bay, most famously, where oil and gas was first discovered on the North Slope in the late 1960s, has become kind of a hub up there, and development has extended outward. But you know, the North Slope and the coastal plain in particular is also home to a number of critically endangered species, including polar bears. The southern Beaufort Sea polar bear population has decreased significantly in recent decades, in part due to loss of sea ice. There are dozens of migratory bird species that nest in the refuge and on the North Slope more broadly. And then, of course, perhaps most notably, the porcupine caribou herd, migratory caribou herd, which uses the refuge as during the summer months, both to calve and to escape the massive, you know, clouds of mosquitoes that inhabit the region as well. So it's this very dynamic landscape that's home to both, you know, Alaska natives and you know, the wildlife that have been supported by this ecosystem for many, many years. And you know, certainly development would add just one, you know, yet one more sort of stressor to a region that's warming, you know, by some estimates, four times faster than anywhere else in the world.
And I'd also note that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge coastal plain has also become a haven for polar bears looking for a safe place to den with their cubs as sea ice
Yes.
is retreating. So we've got the impacts of fossil fuel burning on sea ice. Now we're going to be drilling in areas that are becoming a refuge for some animals like polar bears, given climate change. So I wanted to ask, in terms of, you know, opening up this land and for roads, drilling, et cetera. As we mentioned, there's going to be a lot of external factors, lawsuits, economics that will play a part in terms of how likely it is to see some of these facilities being deployed on the landscape. So, how likely in your mind is it that drilling is actually going to take place?
Yeah, that's probably the hardest question to answer. I mean, there have been two lease sales, you know, in the refuge. The first was actually on January 6, 2021, and I remember very clearly because as I was watching the Capitol, you know, being stormed by rioters, the BLM was holding the first ever lease sale in the refuge. Just a tiny number of bidders, including the state of Alaska. A second lease sale at the end of the Biden administration yielded zero bidders, and they actually didn't even bother to have the sale. So there's been little to no interest in developing the coastal plain, I think, for a variety of reasons. But you know, that doesn't mean that we won't see newcomers put their hat in the ring and try to buy up leases in the refuge. And you know, given that they have a longer lead time with this second administration, I do think there's a good chance we'll see seismic exploration in the coastal plain, which also has environmental impacts. But as you mentioned, there will be legal challenges, and you know, these things can get gummed up you know, in the court. So it's hard to say. I do th What we do know is that there is a lot more interest and activity to the west of the refuge on state land and in the National Petroleum Reserve, which is where the massive Willow Project was approved under Biden, and you know, where ConocoPhillips is continuing to kind of expand its network of pipelines and rigs to the west, and the Department of the Interior also plans to hold new lease sales there going forward. So we will see new drilling activity on the North Slope, undoubtedly, I think.
You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. We're talking to Adam Fetterman, award-winning journalist and reporting fellow with Type Investigations, about the Trump administration's decision to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling, to roads that would support that oil and gas drilling. If you have questions or comments for Adam, concerns about what this might mean for the environment, for climate change, for the ecosystem in Alaska, the number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email those questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Adam, so much of the decision for these firms as to whether or not to drill really depends on the price of oil, which is a global commodity. Can you talk about the economics here for these firms and how that might impact whether or not they move forward on drilling in any sort of significant way?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the margins are always thinner in the Arctic just because of how difficult it is to get up there and the costs associated with exploration and development. I mean, one of the reasons why I think drilling to the west on the North Slope is more attractive is because there is more infrastructure. There are roads, pipelines, et cetera, that the industry can build on. And the refuge, because of its status as a protected landscape, doesn't have that same kind of infrastructure. So if industry is going to move ahead, for example, with both seismic exploration and then drilling in the coastal plain, they're going to have to put in ice roads during the winter construction season, and then the other infrastructure required to develop a resource that remains, you know, the amount of which remains a real question. And and it's not only the logistical difficulties, but it's also the sort of the liabilities that would go along with drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, there's a reason why the major oil companies don't want to touch it, because, you know, their reputations are already toxic, given what we know about the climate change and sort of where we're headed. And I think that, you know, taking on that added, you know, liability is not something that, you know, Exxon and BP and others are going to do. But it doesn't mean that smaller players won't try to, develop the refuge. And also, I should add, native corporations, mm-hmm. which own a significant portion of the resources in the coastal plain, have also been very enthusiastic about oil and gas drilling up there. So, whatever the price of oil is, you know, in 10 years or, you know, however long it's going to take them to develop the coastal plain, you know, remains very much an open question.
Yeah. And then native Alaskans, of course, have corporations that they can use to do these kinds of development projects due to special law passed in the 1970s in the U.S. giving the natives essentially that sort of corporate rights and powers. And let's talk about those indigenous groups up there. I know that there are two distinct indigenous groups that consider the Arctic Refuge to be their traditional lands, and they're apparently split on whether or not this fossil fuel development can go forward. Can you talk about the indigenous groups up there, how serious that divide might be?
Yeah, I mean, the Gwich'in have long opposed drilling and development in the refuge. They rely on caribou, which, as I mentioned before, you know, migrate across the coastal plain during the summer. In contrast, some of the native Alaska Native villages, you know, on the coastal plain, namely Kaktovik, which is the only settlement actually within the refuge itself, have been much more supportive of oil and gas leasing and development. And the main corporation there, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, has advocated for that for many, many years, and is incredibly powerful and influential in the region. But I would say, I mean, I was up in Kaktovik in 2019 for one of the Bureau of Land Management's public meetings on the program. And I was surprised to see just how much dissent there was and how much, not necessarily outright opposition, but just skepticism and questions about the program in general, because I wasn't necessarily expecting that. So a lot of assumptions, I think, are made about, how people on the North Slope feel about oil and gas development in particular. And you know, I think as the impacts of climate change become more and more pronounced, you know, we may see opinion change in the coming years, you know, as this development sort of moves forward.
And it's not just oil and gas drilling up there also, but minerals as well. There may be some large copper deposits, for example. How is that economic potential playing into these debates?
It's huge. I mean, the economic potential is touted as the, why these projects essentially should move forward. And the big one is this Ambler Road project, which, I mean, it's really remarkable what's happened in the last couple of weeks, because not only did the administration announce that it was, wanted permits approved for this road, which is very controversial among Alaska Natives and also the hunting and angling community in Alaska, but the administration through the Department of Defense also announced that it was taking a 10% equity in the mining company that is, digging for zinc and copper. So the company's stock just shot through the roof, and shareholders, have made out very well. So there's a lot of money being made, even though, no mining or revenue has been generated yet. And this road is going to be massively expensive. It's going to have all kinds of environmental impacts, and the state really still hasn't explained how it's going to pay for it and make it happen. So there's a lot to watch on that front. And it's not the only mining project that is attracting interest in Alaska, for sure.
I'm sure. Well, we have an email question. We're almost out of time here, but I want to get this question in. Leslie Doty writes in to ask, doesn't the melting of the permafrost increase the risk of drilling accidents? So Adam, any thoughts on how essentially climate change might make these climate change worsening projects feasible or not?
It's an excellent question. It's something I've written about in the past. It's something that I think the oil and gas companies have had very little to say about publicly. And not only how it's going to impact, current and new projects, but what it means for existing infrastructure up there that's no longer, producing. How are they going to deal with? I mean, we actually know that most of the near surface permafrost on the North Slope is going to be gone by the end of the century. So it's something that should be factored into every, environmental impact statement conversation we have about these projects. And my impression is that, we are starting to see some problems. There was a gas leak at a ConocoPhillips operation on the North Slope a couple of years ago, and the thawing permafrost contributed to the ability of the gas to make its way up through the ground and ultimately be released into the atmosphere. So it's a major, major issue for that part of the world, undoubtedly.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time, but I just real quick just wanted to ask you about the prospects of lawsuits by environmental groups against the drilling. Is there daylight there, just briefly?
There's always daylight. And I think the environmental community has been anticipating this, and they have a strategy mapped out to challenge it.
All right, well, we'll have to see how this plays out. But Adam Fetterman, journalist reporting and a reporting fellow with Type Investigations, also author of the book Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray, which was a New York Times notable book in 2017. Thank you for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series and talking about what's happening up in Alaska.
Always a pleasure, Ethan. Thanks a lot.
Well, that's our show for today. Tomorrow, Rose Aguilar will be back to discuss how the government shutdown has been affecting the SNAP food benefits for people who rely on those to put food on their tables for their family. So tune in tomorrow for that episode. And to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit our page on kalw.org. We're also on iTunes, where you can give us a review and follow us on social media and email any show ideas and feedback you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.